Eva Kamenetsky, who is the Director of Religious Guidance and Tanakh Teacher at SKA in Hewlett, and she has been involved in formal and informal Jewish education for over 25 years, and she'll be speaking today about Bishvili Nivrah Olam, understanding the unique meaning.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Tova. And Asher Kokochem to everybody for coming out. I'm always so amazed at how many people on a busy Sunday managed to make space for this kind of a program. Okay, my topic this morning is actually not much of a chiddush, not much of something brand new. It's the concept of the Shvili Nivrah Olam, the world was created for me. Not necessarily plan on uncovering major chidushim with this discussion, but very similar to the way that the Ramchal in his introduction to Nesilat Yesharim suggests that there are topics and ideas that we need to review, either, and this is I'm paraphrasing a little bit, because it's such an important fundamental concept, or because it's a concept that can have more applications than we possibly imagine. A very similar concept to the Mishnah Torah Sefer that we have, Sefer Devarim, where things are repeated either because they are of great importance to Bnei Yisrael right before Moshe Rabbeinu's death, or because there perhaps are new ways to think about it from the way that it had been said originally and to apply it. I'd like to focus on this topic of the world that was created, when the world was created for me. Now, most of you are probably familiar, tracing its origins, actually something in the Gemara that refers to this, about the notion that people should walk around with two notes in their pockets. There's a note in the pocket, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I am the dust of the earth, and there's a note in the pocket, the world was created for me. I'm it. Okay? I have great importance, and if nobody else existed in the world, it would still be valuable for the world to exist just because of me. Okay? Now, even though we know that there are two notes in our pockets, and clearly they're opposite ends of the spectrum, and they're meant to somehow create a balance in our perspective, I'm a lonely nothing to I'm it, the reality is, and I don't know if this is true of everybody, but I personally never really saw it as a 50-50. Somehow, the promotion of anava and modesty makes it seem like we should kind of err a little bit onto the anochi afar ve'efer side, maybe walk around like this in our pockets, as opposed to really seeing it as like an equal balance in the shikul and in the spectrum in that way. And to be very honest, I can go back to pretty early in my career, thank God, but when a colleague suggested that in a school that I was working in that we have as a theme for our major program, Bishvili Nivrah Olam, I kind of cringed. Like, what? Like, that's not something you really promote. We have enough of that in our world. And clearly in today's world, where we battle narcissism, entitlement, and so many things that seem to be driven by this concept of Bishvili Nivrah Olam, it's hardly a notion that we feel that we have to better understand or promote. And yet, I think there are things that are important to recognize about the notion and the important role that it plays in terms of our lives, so that perhaps we shouldn't be so lopsided. Perhaps there is something about the way that we approach things that should be such that we have a more even and supportive concept of the Shvili Nivrah Olam. And just to, the things that I'm going to share with you today, the theme of the day is about strengthening families. I'm going to share with you things that I think are important for any children that we come in contact with, whether it's our own children, whether it's students, whether it's our grandchildren, whatever stage it might be, why it's important to keep this notion in mind. But I also think that it's not just a notion that's important to stress and to strengthen among people who we interact with, but actually an important notion for us, the mentors, the influencers, the teachers, in whatever capacity that might be, to keep in mind for ourselves, that we have a uniqueness and a unique mission in this world. Now, over the last few years, I saw two things that seem to represent this approach, or this quantum, I should say, about the balance that should exist between these two things that were actually both very powerful. One is a YouTube video that you haven't seen. It's a real must, okay? It's the commencement exercise for Wellesley High School in 2012. The title of the video, I hope I'm getting it right, is You Are Not Special, or You're Nothing Special. But if you just put in You Are Not Special, it's going to pop up right away, went completely viral. And the premise is that this school in the Midwest, and it's an interesting thing that they do, their keynote speaker is never somebody from the outside, it's always a faculty member. In this case, I believe he was the head of the English department, addressed the graduating class. And it's very clearly a super academic and successful school. It's very clearly a place of great accomplishment, where the students are headed on to great things, show great promise. And yet, the theme of his commencement speech is, you're not special. And he goes on to say that if there are 3.2 million seniors from high school, not senior citizens, graduating high school that particular June. So right away, you think you accomplished high school, pat on the back, okay, 3.2 million other people have done the same thing. And there are 37,000 high schools across America, that's how he got that number, which means that there are 37,000 high school valedictorians, right? So again, even if you think you're special among the special people who have gotten through high school, you're really not all that special. And that also means that the 37,000 class presidents and captains of the teams, etc. So therefore, realize that you are not really one in a million. And even if you think you're one in a million of 608 billion people that exist in the world, that means there are 7,000 people just like you. That's the conclusion. So this went, and he basically goes on, and I have to be very honest with you, there are pieces of it that deeply resonate, where, you know, he questions the way that we pump people up to think that they're awesome and the best and that they're the greatest. He makes references to a topic that's near and dear to my heart about not setting up students for failure, for resistance, for difficulty in life, not training them to be resilient, but constantly pumping them that you are the best, you are the best. And he, in essence, rails against that particular notion. Last summer, a friend of mine suggested an interesting book called To Fill the Sky with Stars. For those of you who are in my age bracket, it's more appropriate for us. It's about transitioning from different stages in life, etc. It's an anthology written by Jewish authors. To be honest, some things resonated very deeply, some things I quickly skipped over, like many anthologies, etc. But I found the entry that is actually the title of the book, okay? To Fill the Sky with Stars. And they shared there something amazing from Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz that I had never, ever seen before. He talked about the bracha that Avraham Avinu, or the promise, I should say, that Avraham Avinu is given, that his children are going to be like the sand and the stars. That's going to be their numbers. That's going to be their multitude. And I have to be honest, like most people, I always understood that bracha as being something that shows the incredible numbers of Klal Yisrael. And I, again, in better parenting moments at the beach, I've picked up grains of sand, asked my kids how many things you think are just in this fistful. Nobody can imagine it. And you make that reference. It's very strong imagery. The same thing on a clear night with the sky, with the stars, etc. But Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz focuses specifically on the comparison to the stars. He actually has suggestions as to, hey, each one must mean something a little bit different. And he says as follows. Remarkably, the stars, Each star has its unique orbit. Some may circle in smaller orbits, and others in an oblong or circuit. But remarkably, the stars do not collide with one another. Each follows its preordained pathway without impinging or imposing on other stars. As members of Klal Yisrael, just like stars, each one of us has her own pathway, her own journey to travel, exactly suited to her task at hand. We've each been given the tools and the talents needed in order to perform our particular mission. There is no reason to be envious of another. We must tend to our path, to our responsibilities as ordained from above. An amazing, amazing limud, lesson to be learned from the stars. Not just that there are so many, and not just that they all shine differently or are shaped differently, but that they each have their own orbit. They each have their own tafkid. And they don't collide with each other, and they don't take away one from each other. There's no reason to be envious of one or the other because you were created in your own circuit and your own orbit. That would seem to imply that there is something very unique and special about me versus you. And it would seem to imply that the sentiment of that commencement address was actually off. That who cares if there are 37 other valedictorians? That there is something very unique and special about who I am and how I approach things. I'd like to just share with you five different aspects towards this concept of Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, our personal uniqueness, and as I said before, some will be things that are important for us to impart to people who we come in contact with, and some are important for us to remember in our specific and unique roles. The first source that you have on your sheets is from Rivolbi in the Alei Shore, Chelek Bet, Ayin Aleph. And he actually is referring to the creation of Adam HaRishon. Now again, these are all things that we take for granted because we've been learning Parsha, most of us, since we're in the early stages of our lives. And it's very hard to question things that you've heard over and over again and that are just givens in your life. But if you think about it, if God's creating the world, and it's supposed to be a big world of people, and the world was created b'shvil reishit, not b'shvil rishon, but b'shvil reishit, for the Klal Yisrael, for all of the Jewish people, then create the world on Yom HaShishi with a nation of people. And yet that's not what happened. There was one individual who was created. Subsequently, and again, we can even ask the question about Chava, create them both at the same time, they're both going to be created, that's it. But there was a slow process, a one-by-one process that took place in terms of populating the world. Says Rav Volpe, that teaches us volumes. That teaches us enormous things. You skip down, and I'm sorry, time is short, so I'm going to go kind of quickly, but honestly, anything that I put on here, I think only adds to the discussion in a significant way, in my opinion. But I'm going to highlight the end, the last five lines of the first paragraph. Kol Adam hu bri'ah chad pa'amit. A funny language, because if you're familiar with modern Hebrew, chad pa'amit is what we refer to as disposable. That's not what we mean here. Chad pa'amit literally means one-time use, okay? So what we're talking about here is not the disposability of people, but rather a unique individual. You are a once-in-a-lifetime creation, okay? There is nothing that is ever going to come to be like you. And again, we know this biologically. We know in terms of fingerprints, we know this even now in terms of security things that will take our eye prints, I guess they're called, eye scans, whatever they might be, right? We know that our DNA is unique to us, right? We know that from a biological standpoint. But in terms of mission, purpose, character, abilities, that is true as well. You are a once-in-a-lifetime creation. V'yadazo kol adam, ani im kochoti v'tchunoti. I have my unique powers and my unique characteristics. Partzuf panai, my particular face, is not something that is going to be repeated anyplace else. Ben kol ha'chayim achshav, ein af echad kamoni. Living today, there is nobody else like me. But not only that, the dorosha avru lo hayah kamoni. The atzof kol adoro lo yiyah kamoni. In the past, nobody ever existed exactly with my potential and abilities. And in the future, nobody is going to be created with my unique combination of traits and abilities. Bevadai, what's the conclusion then? HaKadosh Baruch Hu shalchani li'olam b'shlichut miyuchedet. If I have a unique combination of characteristics and abilities, and I have been placed here on this earth with a unique mission, sheshom acher eino yachol lamlo ota, that nobody else can possibly fill the way that I can fill it. Rak ani b'chad kamoti. Only I, with my once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and ability, can actually fulfill that role and that place in this world. What an incredibly empowering statement. It's the type of thing you feel like you want to read every morning before when you wake up, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, I can make things happen today in a way that nobody else on this earth can make things happen. What an amazing, amazing message to give over to our children, to our students, to anybody we come in contact with, to our neighbors. I value you and appreciate you for who you are and what you can accomplish in this world.
And who said this?
What, this is Rav Volpe, Rav Shlomo Volpe. Well, one, take this a step further, and there are others who say that not only is this something which is empowering, but actually, Tal Ben Shachar, a studier of positive psychology, very well known in the last few years, and many others before him, Martin Seligman and others, have said, this is the key to happiness. That if a person feels that they are mission-driven, that they have reason and purpose on this earth, they are, and this has been statistically and scientifically supported and proven, they are going to be happier people. It's not how much money they have, it's not how much fame and fortune they have, but rather, it's this empowerment that you are valuable and uniquely valuable for who you are. Second source on the at the bottom of the page. A famous Gemara in Sanhedrin, Kishem Shishayan Hashem, Kishem Shepartusehem Shonot, Kafto Tehem Shonot. We have to recognize, as we spoke before, about the fact that our fingerprints are different, that our eye scans are different, that our unique missions are different, that our deot are different as well. Our deot is our intellectual capacity. how we view things, how we understand things, how we make decisions, how we value things, how we prioritize things. So Dr. Abraham J. Twersky asked actually the same question as Revolvi. You know, why was Adam created yichidi? Why was he created as one person when in reality the goal was to populate the earth with many people? And he responds in the following way. He suggests that the reason for this is that we tend to, I'm in the third paragraph, we vote in blocks and think in blocks. The human race has a tendency to function as a block society. We are influenced by mass media, major corporations, and by the leaders of educational institutions. Indeed, the educational system is criticized by forcing all students into the belly of the bell curve, resulting in mediocrity as well as uniformity. There's a certain sense of do as everybody else does. And we, it's an interesting question to ask ourselves, how much we promote individuality and uniqueness in our systems. When I say systems, yes, I mean schools, yes, I mean shuls, yes, I mean larger community, in whether it's dating or in our shul systems or whatever it might be, but I also honestly mean in our families, right? To what extent is there, this is what Kamenetskys do, this is what Kamenetskys don't do, or whatever it might be. And is there a certain sense of block mentality? And if you think about it, we've come across this a lot. There's certain assumed norms that go on and that take place. One of my own things, which I think is a double-edged sword, on the one hand, it's beautiful that it's become an assumed norm, that many students post-high school spend a year in Israel. I think that's an amazing thing, great thing for Israel, great thing for Jewish education. Chaval, that far too many of them never stop to think about why they're going, what they're seeking. What is their dea, or is it just we go and we do in that way? And he goes on to suggest, and that's what he means by mediocrity as well as uniformity, that when things are just done because they're done, they are mediocre by nature. At the end, he suggests, it may be more convenient to follow the herd instinct. This spares us the need to think for ourselves. However, if happiness is the result of self-fulfillment, we may be sacrificing happiness for convenience. He suggests here at the end, once again, leading to happiness, that if we don't encourage people to think for themselves, and there's so many simple ways that we can do this, I really mean about, and you don't have to be crazy about this, but what do you want for dinner? Okay, I want mac and cheese. Ask your child. Why? I'm just curious, right? Now again, you don't have to grill them. You don't have to give us a sophisticated answer with five proofs or whatever it might be. But helping people start to think about how they make choices. And of course, larger choices will have more significant answers, right? Why is this something that's important to you? How come you value it? Again, very key, asking the question in a very non-judgmental way. It's not like there's a right or wrong answer. I'm not waiting to hear something. I'm not going to pounce on your answer and suggest why I think differently. But I want to encourage you to answer the question of why. Why do you think the way that you think? And I find that whenever I ask people that question of why, sometimes they're very taken aback and a little far. That's why it has to be done in as disarming a way as possible, non-judgmental. But they're actually, there's a part of them that's flattered, right? You really care about why I think what I think. My opinion matters to you. It's a value to me. So again, the goal of the why is not to change their mind or their opinion, but to see that there's depth to how their dea is being established. Because unfortunately, we do live in a world that really creates this kind of uniformity, which ultimately leads to mediocrity. So just to review, number one was the sense of empowerment. I was created for a mission and purpose, and I can fulfill and conquer and do and accomplish. Number two, to encourage individual thinking, that we don't have to have a herd mentality. We don't just have to do because everybody else is doing. Number three was actually referred to in the To Fill the Sky with Stars little quote that I read at the beginning. And that is that I believe that promoting this concept of Bishvili Nivra HaOlam can deeply help in the area of midos and midos development, primarily in the area of jealousy, right? Of a sense of feeling that other people have what I want to have. How do we see that? So there are many sources here on the page. Time is short. I'm going to refer to each of the sources. But we'll start with a very famous discussion about the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, who we know died through a plague that ceased on Lag BaOmer. 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died of this plague. Again, one of these things, we've heard that number our whole lives. That's a mind-boggling number, okay? Not only is it a mind-boggling number, but the reason why they died is actually a little strange. There's one girsa which tells us, Shalom nahagu kavod zebazet. There's another girsa which I quoted here from the Bereshis Rabba. V'chulam beperek achad mesu, they all died at one time. Lama shahayo einehem tzara elu la'elu. They had what we refer to as tzaras ayin. There was negative behavior between them. Now this is a little bit, again, if we really stop to think about this, this is a pretty crazy story. Okay, they weren't so great with v'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, and that's why Rabbi Akiva, you know, part of the reason why that was such an important mantra to him, etc. We are not dealing with fourth graders in the playground, though, okay? We're dealing with mega talmidei chachamim, okay, who we would think would have basic midos, basic etiquette, right? That they wouldn't be at each other's throats over petty behaviors, that these things wouldn't bother them in little ways. Shalom nahagu kavod zeh bazeh, they'd hold the door open for each other, right? That they, what does it mean? So if we look more carefully at this lashon of tzarus ayin, there's a very, very important lesson here, which is worthy of an entire discussion in and of itself. Tzar, tzadi reish, kol olam kulo geshe tzar ma'od, is a lashon of narrow, right? It means that your existence narrows me. That my relationship to you somehow makes me feel small and narrow. Now, in the field of sociology and psychology, there are actually three different types of relationships that you can have with people. You can have a completely independent relationship. In my mind, every time I think about independent relationship, I think about two-year-olds parallel play. They happen to be in the room. He's playing with blocks. I'm playing with Lego, but that's about it, right? Completely independent relationship. You can have a negative, a positive interdependent relationship. Let me start with that. And that's what we would call cooperation, right? Where we're both here together, and we're going to work on this project together. You're a fabulous artist. I'm a great researcher. And we're going to put together the best presentation possible. Here there is enormous interdependence, but it's super duper positive, okay? Everybody respects each other, and we're each doing right there. The third type is something we call negative interdependence. And I always, imagery that I always have in my head for negative interdependence is a seesaw. What it means is that when you have a success, somehow I feel lowered by that success. When you have a success and you rise up, I feel like I'm at the bottom of the seesaw in that way. And again, there are many, many times in life that this happens, and it's a very, very common phenomenon. The question is, how can we avoid that phenomenon? Because it doesn't really make sense. I have witnessed many a student do extremely well on a test, but be absolutely devastated that they got a 96 and other girls got 100. Now, how do we respond as parents generally to that? In either direction, by the way. You know, your child comes home with a 74 and says that everybody else failed. What do we say? There's no interdependence to this discussion, right? You did what you did. I don't really care who got 4 points higher or who got 20 points lower. There is no association. This is your work, your effort, and it's not a seesaw kind of dynamic. Yet many people see things in this particular way. At Baruch Hashem, this is not a phenomenon among anybody who I know personally now, but I remember growing up, my mother and her friends being very frustrated about people who shared recipes and left out an ingredient. Because somehow, if you have the full recipe and your cake comes out better than my cake, right? But I can tell from the reaction in the room, this is not a foreign concept, right? Now, what should it be? I should actually be flattered, I would think, right? I make a great cake. You want my recipe? That's great, okay? But that's not the way people function. I want to be the best blueberry pie maker in town, right? And somehow, if you start to bake well, what's going to happen? It's going to affect my status as a baker. That would be negative interdependence in that way. And unfortunately, time is very short. Time is over, my gosh, okay? But there can be lots of examples of this. When I feel b'shvili nivra ha'olam, when I say, this is my course, the child who gets their grade, whatever the grade may be, high, low, mediocre, I don't really care, and says, this is me and this is my effort. And maybe my effort could have been stronger, or maybe I did the best that I could. That's a separate discussion. This is a child who recognizes that they are a star in their orbit, and that they don't collide or impinge on anybody else's orbit. And the same thing's true for the person who has a larger house, and the same thing's true for a person who has more money. Velo shayach li. This is my orbit. The Eben Ezra very beautifully suggests that this is how there could be a mitzvah of lo tachmod. How could there possibly be a mitzvah that commands your emotions? Jealousy is natural. You look at a nine-month-old baby, and he sees his mother pick up another child. He cannot articulate a thing, right? He can't say I'm hungry, he can't say I'm tired. But he makes darn clear that what? He's jealous. But Nassim HaShalom says that is a natural development. So why is there a mitzvah that says what? Lo tachmod. Says the Eben Ezra, it's an intellectual mitzvah. It's not an emotional mitzvah. It's the realization, I'm paraphrasing now, b'shvili nivra ha'olam. I have been given what I need for me, and you have been given what you need for you. And if I have my unique tafkid, or in the words of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, I have my unique orbit in the world, then I have all of the tools and all of the kalim that I need to accomplish my mission. So you got a bigger house. You have more cars. Whatever it might be, that doesn't matter. You have more children. It doesn't matter what realm it's in. That means that I believe that Hashem has given me what I need. It's actually interesting. It's a mitzvah memuna, lo tachmod. It's a belief that Hashem has provided me with what I need, when I need it, and how I need it in that way. It's actually a beautiful concept to think about in the morning in the Birchas HaShachar with the bracha of Sha'asa Li Kol Tzarki. I believe that Hashem has given me what I need to fulfill my unique mission. So in this way, if we can believe in our strength in ourselves and impart to others the importance of recognizing b'shvili nivra ha'olam, we will be helping support our midos against concepts of tzoras ayin, the narrow vision of I narrowed when somebody else is made greater, as well as overall kinah v'tava. I want to just share with you very briefly the next few sources because they're very beautiful. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs has a beautiful explanation for a pasuk in Hazinu, which talks about the Torah falling on us like rain and dew. And most people, there's a very common understanding that the Torah is often compared to water. Water is the source of all life. Torah is our spiritual sustenance, and that's where it's at. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, quoting a Medrash, actually expands on this even further. And what he suggests is the following. And again, to be honest, until I read this, I never thought about this. He says, rain is awesome. The same rain falls, perhaps even just all around my backyard. But let's expand it a little bit more around my neighborhood, around the region. And the same water is able to affect different plants and vegetations in a way that allows them to sprout uniquely. Meaning it's not like water comes down and now all of a sudden everybody has daffodils. That's not what happens. Water comes down, and the unique plants, the unique seeds that have been planted in the ground, are able to develop in their own unique way. Says Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, that is the koach of Torah. Look at a day like today. Torah is being taught throughout this building, and people are able to access Torah at different times, through different presentations, on different topics that speak to them uniquely. People will learn Torah, the same pasuk, and it can mean different things to different people. I'll learn the same pasuk multiple times, and it will speak to me in different ways. The relationship to Torah and Torah's relationship to us has a b'shvili nivra ha'olam aspect in the sense that there is a uniqueness. Some people attach to Torah through chassid thought. Some people attach to Torah through more intellectual thought. Some people love a certain niggun, a certain song, a certain pasuk. Some people love a certain tefillah that just doesn't speak as deeply to other people. Torah itself has this capacity to affect us and for us to be enriched by it in each of our own unique ways. The last two things which I just want to mention, which I think are extremely powerful, one again comes from the L.A. Shor, and the second is from a completely secular source actually on business. But the last L.A. Shore source in the packet actually makes reference to a very famous pasuk and the gra there as well. The pasuk is in Mishlei, Holech b'yisharo yirei Hashem. Somebody who walks in a straight path is a yirei Hashem. Generally, the word that's emphasized in that pasuk is yashar. If you walk on a straight path, then that makes you a yirei Hashem. The gra actually highlights that it's not just yashar, the derech yashar, yishro. He creates his own straight path. Now again, of course, it's within the framework, the Dalai Lama's of halakha. I'm not suggesting that Judaism, you know, we can all have our own creative religions, because then there wouldn't be anything that binds us at all. But the Gra here says that we have to recognize that we all have our own methods. And whether it's we're parents, we're teachers, we're mentors, in any capacity, whatever it might be, just because somebody else has a different system doesn't mean that that's the right system for you. And again, this is a hard thing to get used to. My youngest daughter went to a sleepover party. She's my youngest, Baruch Hashem. Zilchah had become a grandmother recently. And that mother stayed up all night and did activities with them through the night. I heard about this all Shabbos morning. Never once did she say, not like you, but that was the implied implication straight through the whole thing. Now, there are a lot of things about that example. Number one, I philosophically actually don't believe in it. Happy she had a great time, but didn't totally appreciate it. Getting my daughter back in that state. Number two, that's just not my thing. Honestly, it wasn't my thing 20 years ago, and it can't be my thing now. And I have to have the confidence that I have my way, and the same way that I approach the Rabbeinu Sha'olam, and the same way that I create a relationship with him, and these things work for me. Maybe I'm a Tehillim zoner. Maybe I like to go over Parsha with Rashi. That's my international connection. Maybe I am a chesed machine, or not a machine. I get sipuk out of helping other people in that way. Number one, we should never judge other people's derech. Each person is unique. Number two, we should have the confidence in our derech, because that's what works for us, even when it doesn't match up with the drachim that are around us. Such an important message, that derech yisharo yarei Elokim. You create Yirah Shamayim through your own unique vistas. And the last source here, which I think is very powerful as well, is a source that refers to authentic leaders. A study that was done about what are the qualities in authentic leadership. My favorite line is actually right in the center of the last page, where they're looking for qualities to say, let's bottle it. Let's find how we make authentic leaders. None of these studies has produced a definitive profile of the ideal leader. Thank goodness. Meaning that there is no, we are not meant to be robots copying and modeling each other. It's not like, my mother always did it this way, therefore I have to do it that way. I have a great mentor, a rebbetzin, a rabbi, whatever it might be. This is their way, I have to do it. I had a great camp counselor. She always was like this. This is what I have to do. That's a disaster. That's called role playing. That's something that's fake. That's when the mask comes off. That's when everybody recognizes your lack of authenticity. What was the ingredient in great leaders? Authentic leadership, being yourself, being somebody who has triumphs and being somebody who has challenges. People appreciate that because they appreciate the human nature of it, but you're also being authentic to yourself. We've all been in situations where we've talked to somebody and we're like, you are playing a role right now. It's like the old commercial about Marcus Welby, I play a doctor on TV, but not in real life, doing robot testing commercials. Like that's like, that nobody appreciates that kind of a relationship. Be yourself and be proud of who you are. And I'll just end with a very, very beautiful nitziv on the bracha that many of us bless our sons with. In Parshas Vayechi, the bracha to be like Menashe and Ephraim. So Menashe and Ephraim are actually fascinating characters. We finally get to the end of Bereishis, and we have brothers that get along with each other. Till this point, it's been a pretty big disaster, okay? Pretty detrimental, in fact. Going from Cain and Hevel straight down. And yet, Ephraim and Menashe are greatly different from each other, from the get-go. There is one who is an interpreter, Menashe, he's involved in the world, he's grew up in Mitzrayim, he knows politics, he knows the secular world, and Ephraim, the phrase Ephrati, used throughout Tanakh, is meant to show nobility through Torah study. Somebody who really knows a lot of Torah and is considered to be a great Torah scholar. So we got Torah and we got Mazda, we got two totally different personas here. And yet, we bless our children to be like Ephraim Umanasha. So again, great for YU, but after that, like, what are we really blessing our children to be like? So the Nitziv suggests that the reason why they got along so well, and the reason why, even when the hands are switched, and one is clearly, there's like a little Kasonis Possum action going on, one is clearly being favored over the other in some way, all these things which we think would lead to a disastrous situation, nobody flinches. Because they each developed their potential in their orbit to the max. And what a gorgeous blessing that we give our children every single week. That they should be like Ephraim and Menashe, not that they should be politicians and translators, that would be fine. And not that they should be Rashi Yeshiva and Lomdei Torah, that would be fine, great also, doesn't matter. But that they should be like Ephraim and Menashe, that they develop their own unique potential, with a sense of confidence. Not necessarily inflated self-esteem, I'm the best, I'm the best, but a sense of I'm unique, and I was created here for a mission and a purpose. I have what to accomplish, and I have a responsibility to put my best foot forward to be the best that I can be, because if not, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never have created me and placed me here in this position. That's the godless of Ephraim the Menashe. That's what we wish for all of our children, for ourselves to have the confidence to nurture the next generation in that way. And Ezra Hashem, with this concept in mind, will have great Hatzlacha.
I have to show you this quote I found actually on Facebook. It's from Rav Nachman of Breslau.
Oh, yeah?
It says, the day you were born is the day God decided that the world could not exist.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's it. That's gorgeous. Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's beautiful, yeah.
Thank you. That was beautiful.